Hello and welcome to the Constructor Cast, your AGC place for all the news, views, and interviews relevant to your construction business. I'm your host, Leah Pilkonis, for today's episode. Today we are diving into a crucial aspect of AGC's advocacy efforts, and that's its litigation program. This program serves as an extension of AGC's government and public relations initiatives, where we're working to advance and protect the interests of the construction industry. In addition to hosting this podcast, I also have the privilege of serving as AGC's general counsel. Joining me are Steve Sander, CEO of AGC, and Jimmy Christensen, the Vice President of Government Relations. Together on this episode, we're going to be exploring how AGC navigates the legal landscape to advocate for the construction industry. Steve and Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
So between the three of us, and not to date us, but we have close to 70 years of service at AGC. And including us, we have a team of 6 full-time attorneys on staff at AGC. So I'm excited to talk with you guys about all the work that we're doing, and we can jump in and get started. So as I said, AGC's litigation program, it's a crucial component of our advocacy for the construction industry. Steve, I'd like to begin with you and ask you to discuss the role of our litigation program within the broader scope of our advocacy efforts. How does the litigation program align with AGC's goals?
Okay, thank you, Leah. So first of all, as I like to remind AGC audiences, AGC is the only construction association that represents the entire industry. And as such, we have an obligation to advance the interests of the entire industry. Our judicial advocacy is one part of the three-legged stool of our government relations program. Obviously, we have legislative, our dealings with the Congress, regulatory, how we try to influence the federal agencies, and then finally, the judicial branch. And in doing so, our objective is to be consistent across all endeavors to advance industry interest and protect the industry from disruption, risk, and other harm. So let me describe the different avenues that we take in engaging in judicial matters. First of all, we file or initiate litigation on our own. That is, we're a party to a suit. And we do this by ourselves or in certain instances in collaboration with others who are like-minded. And I'll give you some recent examples of that. We filed a lawsuit on our own when the federal government put out a vaccination mandate for all federal contractors. And we were successful there. The government finally backed down on that requirement. And then an issue where we collaborated with others would be a similar issue, which was when OSHA came out with an emergency standard requiring most employers to vaccinate their workforce. Outside the authority of OSHA, we linked up with 2 other trade associations, the American Road and Transportation Builders Association and another small subcontracting association, and worked together to bring about the proper result there, which was to force OSHA to abandon their efforts to impose a vaccination mandate. We also file what are known as amicus curiae briefs, and that's law school Latin for friend of the court. These are briefs where typically it's in an appellate court. It's where we have the opportunity to inform the court or raise issues that may not be raised by the litigants in the judicial proceeding. It's an opportunity for us to tell our story of how an improper result in that litigation could impact the construction industry. We want to be able to tell our story and educate the court on how certain actions that they may take may benefit or harm the industry. A good example of that is we've been involved over the years in state litigation dealing with insurance companies covering under a CGL policy, covering construction defects and making sure that contractor can enforce that policy to get compensation for those defects. We typically do that in partnership with our chapters because these cases are primarily at the state level. That's how we get engaged in judicial advocacy.
Great. Thanks for that, Steve. As you just shared, a lot of the cases included in our litigation program, they're there because they provide us with an opportunity to improve and protect larger bodies of law. So like construction, labor, employment, environmental, Steve just talked about insurance law. There are other cases, and Steve, you touched on these too, but to differentiate between the two that are in our program that challenge government authority, typically focused on specific regulatory actions or decisions made by the government. Steve, you mentioned OSHA, also involved in some actions over EPA regs. So Jimmy, I'd like you to chime in here and talk about, are litigation goals for lawsuits in opposition to government regulations? And talk a little bit about that.
Of course. Thanks, Leah. Our objective here is when we do find that there are regulations that the industry is interested in, our goal is to block those regulations where compliance is unreasonable, unachievable, or just downright unfair. The industry is interested in a level playing field. You want to be competing for bids and work on an even playing field. And sometimes these regulations, there's so much ambiguity, a lack of clarity, where you can have a wide range of different approaches to those regulations, which may be unfair for one contractor as compared to another. And that's something that we are looking to block in any litigation. To the point where Steve was talking about these amicus briefs, these friends of the court briefs, the focus there, as well as in our direct litigation, is to ensure that the court understands the impacts that these regulations have on the construction industry. Because if we don't tell that story, no one else will. We also obviously seek to block regulations that are inconsistent with existing law, because part of the process here is to ensure that we have this three-pronged approach, as Steve discussed, and we're in the Congress. So the activities that we have in Congress to prevent bad law from coming out, we have to complement that to ensure that the agencies don't create bad law where Congress didn't actually do it. So we see this in these cases where we're seeking to challenge the legality or the constitutionality of government actions to protect the construction industry interests, or the fact that the government itself didn't follow its own rules, whether that's through the Administrative Procedures Act or some other procedural requirement, where they need to actually understand what the impacts on the industry are and listen to us as an industry so that they can come down from the ivory tower and realize, hey, this is what's actually going to happen if you do this, and you don't want to do this for these reasons.
Steve, how does AGC decide when it's appropriate to take action in the courtroom?
The first threshold question is this a federal or a state issue? If it's a state issue, we only will get involved with the collaboration and permission of our chapters in that particular state. And this typically provides us with a good opportunity to partner with our chapters to hopefully bring about a good result in that state. The way that we evaluate requests for litigation assistance is we listen to our members and our chapters first and foremost. It's most common for AGC to join or weigh in on a pending case in response to requests for litigation support that we receive from our chapters, our members, or other stakeholders. And in that evaluation, we are fortunate that sprinkled throughout AGC's committees and divisions and councils, we have many attorneys who are quite proficient within their area of expertise, and they are very generous with their time and their knowledge in giving us feedback and providing a solid sounding board to help us evaluate when or how to respond to a particular request. I'd like to point out that they do this for free and without any expectation that they'll do legal work for us on this case or any other case. So we're very grateful to have that support. We also obviously talk to our different volunteer groups and division leadership to understand the impact and on a piece of pending litigation and how it will affect different sectors or markets or firms within AGC. When we collect and harvest all of that information, we go to our leadership and make a formal request that we participate in that litigation, whether it's AGC filing or initial piece of litigation on our own or with other like-minded parties, or whether it's getting involved in the friend of the court briefs. So we seek to ensure that every legal action we take aligns with our mission and serves the best interest of the construction industry. So, Leah, with that in mind, how does AGC of America determine if and when to seek partnerships with other trade associations or collaborate within a coalition for litigation support?
Thanks, Steve. That's a great question. And AGC evaluates the potential for partnerships or coalition work based, of course, on the nature of the case, the impact it's going to have on the construction industry. But if other groups have interests that really align with ours, it can definitely be a win-win to work together, where we're trying to put forth legal or policy issues that are important to all of our members. Frequently, we join other trade associations and business groups on the front of the court briefs that we've been talking about. Here, we can join together with other like-minded groups trying to put new material in front of the court, trying to take a deeper dive on a particular issue. We're very careful with our amicus briefs not to be redundant. We don't want to repeat what the parties to the suit have already told the court. I also want to mention, though, that sometimes we are asked to partner and we decline and pursue other avenues for action because we're always very carefully considering our relationships and maintaining the relationships that we have with the regulatory agencies, for example. We are not interested in just having a press release moment. We are trying to have the greatest impact that we can and really evaluate our likelihood for success when we're getting involved. What we want to do next is, between the three of us, we want to give you a snapshot and kind of a highlight of some of the current issues that AGC's tackling through litigation. But it's always, I think, great to start with some successes and some wins. And we had some great successes with amicus briefs before the U.S. Supreme Court last year. So I want to ask Steve to first start off with some of those victories.
We had three straight weeks where the court ruled in our favor on cases that we were involved in. The first case was an unusual case for us to be involved in. It dealt with criminal fraud. And I think our listeners are probably surprised. Why is AGC filing a friend of the court brief in the U.S. Supreme Court in a criminal fraud case? Well, the answer is because it involved a contractor who was asked by a quasi-public agency to assist them in drafting an RFP for a significant construction project. I think the project ended up being about $750 million. Unfortunately for the contractor, the quasi-public agency was in New York State, and it was populated by some political allies of then-Governor Cuomo. And contemporaneous with this, a U.S. attorney in New York State was investigating the Cuomo administration for unpolitical corruption issues. As it turned out, the contractor that assisted the agency in developing the RFP ended up being selected to build the project. From all accounts, the project was completed successfully. The state of New York and the quasi-public agency that oversaw the construction had no claims or concerns, or there were no outstanding defects in the project. From all accounts, it was a successful project. Nevertheless, the U.S. attorney, in investigating this activity, decided that the contractor had engaged in criminal fraud and conspiracy to commit fraud because he relied on an element of proving fraud that was somewhat ambiguous and also did not require the alleged harm party to demonstrate any economic harm or loss. We were concerned that if this conviction were to stand, it would have a chilling impact on contractors who are asked to provide information by public owners about a project before it goes out to bid. And these conversations are common in the industry. They are, in some cases, recommended, and in some cases, they're required. We wrote an amicus brief. We did it in cooperation with our New York State chapter, and we made all these points about how contractors should not have to have a lawyer sitting by their side when they have discussions with a public owner prior to bid. We think that exchange of information is beneficial to both parties, and the Supreme Court evidently agreed with us, because in a 9-0 decision, they held in favor for the contractor. So we think we did the industry a great service by being engaged in this case. Not a lot of people know about it, but it's a great example of AGC stepping in by ourselves to protect the interests of the industry. So the second Supreme Court case where we were successful was a case dealing with the National Labor Relations Act. And the question presented was whether or not employers during a labor dispute who suffered economic harm because of the union's activities could collect damages in state court from the union. And the facts are, we had a situation where ready-mix companies were about to be struck by the Teamsters Union. On the day that the strike was to occur, the Teamsters drivers showed up for work at various employers, got in their ready-mix trucks, and ostensibly to go deliver the product to job sites. While they were out on dispatch, the Teamsters called for the strike to commence. The drivers pulled their trucks to the side of the road. To their credit, they left the engines of the trucks running so that the drums would continue to turn and not spoil the product. Unfortunately, though, the management employees who retrieved the trucks and brought them back to their home base subsequently had to dump the product in the trucks because of the strike, deliver it to the job sites that the product was intended to go. The employers sued the unions for this economic damage in state court, and this was in the state of Washington. At the trial court and at the appeals court in the state level and at the Supreme Court of the state of Washington, it was held that the employers could not sue the Teamsters for damages because the harm occurred during a labor dispute, and as such, that was preempted by the National Labor Relations Act, and so they could not secure a state remedy. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held that the employees here, the union, owed the employers a duty of care because it was reasonable for them to believe that the employers would suffer economic harm by their actions, notwithstanding the fact that it was occurring during a labor dispute. And so because of that decision, the employers were able to recover damages from the Teamsters Union. This has a big impact, not only on union contractors who, during the course of a strike or other labor dispute, could suffer economic damages and now would be able to recover from the union. But it also, for non-union contractors, where a union is trying to organize them, and some individuals associated with the union might engage in some activities that would cause economic damage to the employer. In that instance, the employer would be able to recover damages from a union. Remarkably, this was an 8-1 decision. So a supermajority of the Supreme Court found against the unions and in favor of employers. So, Leah, the last one was an environmental case. Why don't you take that?
So in the third case that we wanted to share with you, the U.S. Supreme Court also sided with AGC's arguments that we made it in amicus brief, reviewing whether intrastate wetlands are considered federally controlled waters or something called waters of the U.S. And the U.S. Supreme Court has actually considered the scope of what is a water of the U.S. in several different cases. It's a definition in regulation written by EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. This definition is super important to AGC and to many other groups because it dictates what waters are under federal control. And for contractors are required to get permits, Clean Water Act permits that cost a lot, take a lot of time, if they're working in and around what is a WOTUS, Water of the U.S. federally controlled water. And it's very serious for the regulated community to just have a clear understanding of this definition, because the Clean Water Act can impose criminal penalties and jail time for violations. So the U.S. Supreme Court, they rejected the use of what we have said for some time is a flawed, significant nexus test for determining when waters require a federal permit or under federal control. And that test really brought in almost everything. They also set a new test for evaluating when a wetland is considered a water of the U.S. So after this Supreme Court decision, which was a great win, the federal agencies published an updated definition of waters of the U.S. And that definition that is currently on the books, we believe still very much exceeds the agency's authority that Congress has given them to control waters and wet areas. And this isn't about whether or not these areas should be protected. It's about what should fall under federal control and what should be left to state control. I'm going to kick off the discussion to give some updates on some current lawsuits, current legal action that AGC is involved in. And to start off, it flows from this U.S. Supreme Court decision. What is the definition of waters of the U.S.? And is the agency, the federal agency's definition, is it consistent with the Supreme Court's decision? And is it following the statute and the authority that Congress gave them? So we were a party in two different federal lawsuits in two different federal district courts where we're challenging the current waters of the U.S. definition. One in Texas, one's in North Dakota. We're working with our AGC of North Dakota chapter. And our AGC of Kentucky chapter actually is a party to a third suit, Kentucky District Court. We're interveners in all of these suits, so we're supporting the many, many states that have brought legal action saying that this definition of waters of the U.S. Is unlawful. So because of our work so far, the rule is on hold in about half the country. And we're asking the courts to find that the rule's unlawful, as I said, because it exceeds government's authority, not consistent with the Supreme Court decision that I just explained, that it violates the procedures that the agencies need to follow in proposing a rule. So this is an effort, just to circle back on some of what we've said previously, where we're working with a coalition of trade groups. We all have a common interest, we want clarity, and we are consistent in our ask, and we're sharing in legal costs. It's very expensive to be a party to litigation, and we're making a powerful statement by working together in a unified voice before these courts. And this is an example of AGC being a party to a federal lawsuit where we're challenging the federal government's recent regulatory action. So we've got some other examples, and I want to ask Steve to talk about project labor agreements and our recent legal action in that area.
Thanks, Leah. Happy to do so. Federal government PLA mandates, project labor agreement mandates, has been like a tennis match over the last 30 or 40 years, where a Democratic administration will come in and want to encourage PLAs. A Republican administration would then come in and want to remove that authority. And then another Democratic administration comes in and reintroduces the policy of encouraging PLAs. And then other Democratic administrations, in particular the current one, want to mandate PLAs on all federal projects in excess of $35 million. So that final rule came out late last year. Recently, AGC, in collaboration with our Louisiana chapter, we filed suit in the U.S. District Court for Western Louisiana, challenging the president's authority to require project labor agreements on federal projects, on projects in excess of $35 million. At first, I should explain our position here and make clear AGC is not opposed to project labor agreements that are voluntarily negotiated between an employer and a union or group of unions on a private construction project. We are not opposed to project labor agreements that are voluntarily negotiated between unions and employers on public projects, if they are voluntarily entered into and agreed to. What our concern is the federal government mandating that parties engage in collective bargaining in order to have the ability to bid on a federal project. And we see this as an intrusion on the rights of both open shop contractors who would be severely limited in their opportunities to bid on federal work, and also on union contractors, because in this situation, requiring them to negotiate an agreement with unions, the unions would have all the leverage because the condition of getting the project is having an agreement, and it gives the unions the opportunity to reintroduce terms and conditions in a labor agreement may have been bargained away over time to make union contractors more competitive. And it also, in many instances, will require employers to hire trades that they ordinarily do not employ. We filed this recently. We may, in sometime in the middle of March, receive word on whether or not our effort to have the administration enjoined from being able to enforce this requirement, because hearings are going to take place in the middle of March there. Jimmy, you want to talk about the Davis-Bacon suit that we're involved in?
Of course. One of the matters we're directly involved is AGC of America, as a sole plaintiff in the litigation, is in the Northern District of Texas with our AGC of Texas chapter, where we are taking on the U.S. Department of Labor for their final rule expanding the reach of Davis-Bacon, not just on construction projects, but work that takes place off construction projects. The proposed rule was one where they really sought to expand the reach of Davis-Bacon far off the job site, to the point where it was questionable whether anything you prefabricated off a construction job site, those workers would have to then be paid Davis-Bacon wages, and any of the reporting requirements under Davis-Bacon would also apply. This was something we were able to, through our regulatory efforts, whittle down. But the final rule took something that was very bad and just bad, and so bad enough that we had to take them to court. The two primary issues among them that I keep hearing are members thanking us for filing this litigation and fighting for them on here are, number one, the lack of clarity now given to when Davis-Bacon applies to truck drivers delivering materials or taking materials off job sites. Previously, the U.S. Department of Labor had regulations where a truck driver was only paid and fell under Davis-Bacon requirements where they spent 20% of their time on a job site. Pretty clear, bright line rule. The final rule, however, gets rid of that bright line and says a truck driver should be considered under Davis-Bacon on a job site if they spend more than a quote-unquote de minimis time on the job site. This is something that every one of our members is talking to us about as an administrative nightmare. How do I track these truck drivers' time when they are or aren't on the job site? When do I determine that it kicks in or not? Another big one that I constantly hear from members about is what I call the invisible Davis-Bacon clause in your contract. There are so many federal dollars flowing out of Washington through COVID relief bills and laws or anything else that you have a lot of traditionally unsophisticated owners or non-federal or non-public works owners getting these dollars where Davis-Bacon requirements attach. And your private contractors or who are doing these jobs or public contractors working with your local school districts that traditionally only have state funding, not federal funding. Well, magically, federal funding has appeared. And those state schools or private entities don't even know that they attach. And they don't include Davis-Bacon in the contract solicitation because they don't know. But what DOL has done in their final rule is say, well, even though these owners, public or private, don't know that Davis-Bacon applied, we're going to make it apply no matter what. And just because they forgot to include Davis-Bacon requirements in a contract, you as a contractor still must pay Davis-Bacon wages and it applies. So this is something that I call the invisible Davis-Bacon clause, and it's patently unfair. You have to be able to bid a project knowing what the owner wants. Otherwise, you have to get paid. And this is a situation where the contractor would be liable for those back wages and the administrative filings without payment. And again, that's patently unfair and why we're in court to overturn this regulation.
A good example of AGC joining another association's suit at the trial court level. And this is a suit that was initiated by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and it deals with a change by the National Labor Relations Board's definition of what is a joint employer. This is an important issue because if two employers are working together and the National Labor Relations Board decides that they are a joint employer, employer A could be liable for unfair labor practices and other violations committed by employer B. And the National Labor Relations Board changed their definition really to target franchises relationships. We are very conversant at AGC about the law of unintended consequences. We are always looking for that to pop up, and this is one of those instances. And essentially what the board did was they changed the definition of joint employer by 180 degrees. The previous standard was if one employer had direct control over terms and conditions of employees of another employer, those two entities for purposes of the National Labor Relations Act would be considered a joint employer. The new rule that came out from the National Labor Relations Board took that direct measurement and made it an indirect measurement. So if one employer had indirect control over terms and conditions of another employer's employees. And the alarm bell that went off for us was, how does this impact the traditional relationship and roles of general contractors and subcontractors on a construction job site? It's pretty clear and apparent to all of us that a general contractor schedules subcontractors' employees can be on the job site, may direct on what areas of the job site it's appropriate for them to be performing their work, requires the subcontractor's employees to comply with all safety rules and protocols at the job site. And there are other areas where a general contractor could be directing what the subcontractor's employees are doing on the site. So we entered into this lawsuit. We provided financial support. We also provided some intellectual support on it because as a condition of us joining the suit, we wanted to make sure we had the opportunity to make clear how perhaps without intention, the change in this definition could have an adverse impact on the normal operation on a construction site where a general contractor does have some indirect control over employees of a subcontractor. That case was filed late last year, and we are hopeful for a positive development there.
Great. I'm going to round out this legal update by touching on some cases that interpret insurance policies and coverage for claims related to construction activities. As Steve kind of alluded to at the outset of this podcast, over the last decade or more, AGC has been involved in a string of successful efforts to establish insurance coverage for construction defects. We've submitted amicus briefs in cases interpreting state insurance law and worked in all of those cases with our chapters in those states. But our latest win came at the end of last year when the Illinois Supreme Court agreed with AGC and all five of its Illinois chapters. We submitted an amicus brief, and the court changed the law in Illinois so that commercial general liability insurance policies do provide coverage for property damage resulting from unexpected or unintended defects in a subcontractor's work, unless a policy exclusion applies. So the Illinois Supreme Court has now joined many other state Supreme Courts in agreeing that such damage is an occurrence in Illinois. The amicus brief that we wrote, we jointly filed with the National Association of Home Builders and the American Subcontractors Association and some of their local chapters. And as I said, we were partnered with all five of our chapters in Illinois. This is pretty significant in Illinois because it overruled numerous prior appellate court decisions, and it rejected the notion that if you've got property damage arising from defective workmanship, previously they said it's an uninsurable business risk that the contractor who has insurance would have to pay for all alone, and the court replaced it with a very clear analysis. That is continuing our string of successful efforts to make sure that contractors have insurance coverage for construction defects. I also want to mention that we're currently involved in two other lawsuits. Similarly, we're trying to make sure contractors get that coverage. AGC National and our AGC of Massachusetts chapter recently filed a brief in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit interpreting Massachusetts law. Very similar question. A decision there is pending. And a third lawsuit in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals on appeal from Florida District Court, where we've submitted a brief working with our Florida chapters. Those are some examples of us trying to shape state insurance law to make sure that we're protecting the construction industry. We're involved in a lot of different things, covering a lot of different areas. Jimmy, I want to kick it back to you because shaping the legal landscape and challenging government decisions requires significant resources and obviously some top-notch legal expertise. So for our listeners who might be curious about the financial side of things, can you share some light on how AGC funds its litigation endeavors and all the things that we've been talking about?
Of course. To win in court and be successful for the industry means that we have to have access to the best and brightest in the legal community. And that has been easier for us to do because we have the Construction Advocacy Fund. This is a financial fund where our members, our chapters, and other stakeholders contribute financial support in order for us to be successful, whether it's litigation, lobbying, research to persuade the public, members of Congress or agencies, be successful. To the point, without the steadfast support of the CAF, our litigation program would struggle to effectively counter the influence of powerful parties and vested interests steering the laws and government policies in unfavorable directions. We have to have access to funds so that we can react quickly, decisively, and go to court. And without the ability to have a well-financed construction advocacy fund, we can't do that. Whatever your interest or stake in the industry is, we consistently ask, and I ask now, that you consider contributing to the Construction Advocacy Fund. For those of you, if you are contractors, you may recall one of the things that I like to remind everybody, we're the only trade association, let alone construction trade association, to file suit against the Small Business Administration when they were administering the Paycheck Protection Loan Program. And they asked for all folks in that program to submit a loan questionnaire. And as part of that, to look back and say, how much are you going to make or how much did you make in the fourth quarter of 2020? And you took out this loan in April or May of 2020 when the pandemic was truly setting in. And the only requirement for getting this loan and getting loan forgiveness was that you were encountering business uncertainty. And the government was here changing the terms of the deal, where contractors had already spent these funds and spent them as they were intended to be used on their employees and business operations, so they did not shut down. We were the only association to file suit when the SBA sought to change the rules to try to deny loan forgiveness. And I had many contractors say, when we did file suit, Shortly thereafter, the SBA changed course and began approving loan forgiveness for our members, which is real hard dollars that went to our members and their employees. And that is a bottom line benefit thanks to the Construction Advocacy Fund and our litigation program. Leah, on that note, how can AGC chapters and members request support for any pending case they believe is likely to have a significant impact on contractors in multiple states?
Thanks for that question, Jimmy. We do have a standard request for litigation support form. It's a pretty short form asking for some details such as the case name and the court, the legal question, procedural history, and most importantly, why is the case nationally significant? And we try to get folks to fill that out in no more than 3 pages. We're not asking for a legal brief. The most credible avenue, if you have a case, is to have an attorney get a litigation support form from us. We encourage our members, and we've said this before, to reach out to their local chapters before coming to National AGC, because we want to make sure that it's an issue that impacts more than just one contractor or just one area. And we're considering issues like the scope of the legal issues involved, the relevance to members, potential for broader industry implications, all the things that we've been talking about during this episode. But bottom line, and Steve said this already, the decision on whether to get involved in a case rests with AGC of America's leadership, and it always involves careful consideration of national impacts and an appreciation for the divergent views within our membership. So we've covered a whole lot. Thank you, Steve and Jimmy, very much for all the insights and information that you shared today. All the work that we talked about today is being done by a team of legal subject matter experts on staff at AGC headquarters, and each bringing different areas of expertise and helping to quarterback our judicial advocacy program. I think it's hopefully clear to everyone who's been listening that AGC is at the forefront of advocating for the construction industry's interests through strategic legal action. So to our listeners, we're going to put some more links in the show notes to provide a little bit more information on the things that we touched on. Please stay tuned for more engaging discussions on our next ConstructorCast. Please subscribe to ConstructorCast from your podcast app or stream all available episodes right from your computer at agc.org/ConstructorCast. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.